Our scripture reading for this morning comes from the 9th chapter of the Gospel according to Luke, beginning with verse 28. This is Luke's account of the transfiguration of Jesus. Now about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And while he was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly they saw two men, Moses and Elijah, talking with him. They appeared in glory and were speaking about his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and his companions were weighed down with sleep. But since they had stayed awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. Just as they were leaving, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it's good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Not knowing what he had said. While he was saying this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were terrified as they entered the cloud. Then from the cloud came a voice that said, "This is my Son, my chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent, and in those days told no one any of the things that they had seen. We think about heights today as the transfiguration comes. This is Transfiguration Sunday. It's the last Sunday before Lent, in which we remember this very strange occurrence. This is one of those things that probably for those who experienced it, whatever they experienced, was almost beyond words. So we think about heights. And when I think about heights, I think about a place in my hometown. And since we're so close to Meriden, probably some of you are familiar with Castle Craig. Are you familiar with that? Okay. I would occasionally talk about it in other places. They'd have absolutely no idea, but you know what it's like. Yet big stone castle that was built by Mr. Hubbard as he gave Hubbard Park to the city. Way up on West Peak, the highest point of land within 50 miles of the entire eastern coast of the United States. It's pretty good. And when I think of heights, this is often the first thing that comes to mind because it goes so far back in my childhood. I used to tell my friends in elementary school that it was named after me. And they really believed me. So they thought that was pretty good, that I had a tower named after me. And I haven't been up there since we've gotten back, but I do hope to get up there in the spring just to see that view again. And it has changed a little bit, as most places do. But the sense that I got of being able to see different places in town that I was familiar with, but to be able to see them all at once, I could see the hill where our house was. And the steeple of our church and the Baptist church next door. And various other places in town. I could see them all just in one view. And it would give me a different perspective on that place because I could see all those spots at once. And of course, you could only be in one of them at any given time. So as we think about Jesus being on the mountain, having a broader view is a general idea we want to keep in mind because that's something that the disciples get an experience of as well. In the ancient world, mountains were very important. Mountains were places in many of the, in fact, probably most of the ancient religions, where people would encounter their gods. And certainly in the Old Testament, mountains are very significant. When somebody is to have an encounter with God, usually it's on a mountain. Think of Moses on Mount Sinai or Elijah on Mount Carmel and various other places. And we even find this, of course, in the Gospels. We even have one part of the Gospel of Matthew called the Sermon on the Mount, as Jesus taught his disciples and his hearers. So mountains are pretty important. And even today, going up onto a mountain can be quite an experience. Partly because of the view, but but just the fact that you're so high and you're above everything else, perhaps even just a little bit separated from the rest of the world, and you get a broader perspective as you can see all around you. So it's no accident that we find this particular scene in the Gospels on top of a mountain. And I've actually seen, although I didn't get up there, Mount Tabor, which is the traditional site of the Transfiguration, and there is a large church, I am told, up there. And interestingly enough, Mount Tabor is called Monadnock. Does that name sound familiar at all?
Yeah,
Mount Monadnock up in New Hampshire, which is a rock, which is a large rock of a mountain that just rises up out of a plain. And so Mount Tabor is a Monadnock, and it certainly rises right out of the middle of a flat plain. It's quite a sight. It's a very tall mountain. So we find Jesus and Peter and John up on the mountain. And the vision that they have is that Jesus' clothing turns white. And there are various little details that depend on which gospel you're reading. And Moses and Elijah appear, and Jesus is talking with them. Moses and Elijah appearing as the two most prominent prophets in the Old Testament. Think to the Passover, where Elijah has a place setting for him at the table at Passover. And Moses, of course, being the prophet who brought the law. And then Peter has this wonderful sense that it just feels so good to be in that place, to see Moses and Elijah there. And the feeling that they have is Jesus seems to be transfigured before them is such a wonderful feeling that he just wants to stay there. We've all had times when you've had just a marvelous experience that was so good that you just didn't want to leave it behind. You didn't want it to come to an end. Well, that's what Peter felt like. And then Peter's idea is that they could build a tent or a booth. It may be that Peter was thinking about the Festival of Tabernacles, the booths, which is a Jewish holiday, and is a very joyous one. In New York City, I'm told that the Hasidic Jews will build their booths on their fire escapes behind their buildings, and they live in the booths for a set period of time. I can't remember how long. And it's a very happy celebration. Perhaps Peter was thinking about that and thinking, wow, we could have this just like the tabernacles. And it feels so good. We just don't want to leave that feeling behind. Well, Peter and John didn't understand this experience at all. And this is one of those experiences described in the scriptures which pushes the limitations of language to describe something that happens. Something that is just so completely different and out of their realm of experience. Perhaps that's why there are different versions of what happened up there. But the basics of this experience are all the same. They see Jesus as more than just what he is as a physical person. And that's no accident, because we find in the Gospel of Luke that the transfiguration is the culmination of that gospel to that point. It is the midway point. After this, Jesus turns his face toward Jerusalem. And everything that he does in Luke's gospel is a part of that journey, that gradual transition down to Jerusalem to the events of Good Friday and Easter Sunday. But what happens afterwards is significant. as they go down from the mountain. And in some of the gospel accounts, Jesus actually says, no, we can't stay up here. We have to go back down because there's work to do. And the stories vary from one gospel to another. In one of the gospels, I don't remember which, the feeding of the 5,000 takes place after, I believe. In Luke, Jesus heals an epileptic boy. The transfiguration is about light. In some branches of the Christian church, the light is called the uncreated light. It is not a light that is a part of creation, but instead is a light that comes directly from God. And the goal of meditation in those traditions is to experience that uncreated light. An enlightenment, really. But as we understand the gospel, the experience on the mountaintop is not the end of the story. Even though the stories vary from one to another about what happens after the transfiguration, the point is clear that we cannot simply reside in that wonderful, cozy feeling that we have or can have in our own experience of God's presence. If we stop there and only think about our own personal experience of God, then we're missing out entirely of what the calling of the gospel is. Jesus doesn't bring them up onto the mountain just so they can have that cozy, warm experience and then go home afterwards as if that's the end of it. No, they go down, Jesus ministers to somebody, and they go on to Jerusalem. The mistake that some Christians make is that our personal experience of Jesus and of God's presence is as far as we need to go. And what we do with our lives otherwise don't really matter all that terribly much. And I would suggest that those branches of the Christian church miss out. And what they miss out on is what the implication of that relationship is. The implication of that relationship is that we can learn from this vision, this presence of God that we experience, and then take it to whomever we are going to encounter. Now, part of this is the old debate in this country over mixing religion and politics. But I tell people that I never preach about political issues. I preach about theological issues that have political implications. So, you've already heard a bit of that. But there is much in this world that the experience of the presence of God informs. It informs how we respond to what we see in the world. It is a theological issue when poor black children in Flint, Michigan are intentionally poisoned by their city and state government. That is a theological issue. It's also an issue of race. It is a theological issue that children go to bed hungry at night in this country, probably in this town. It is a theological issue that during the time that I am standing here and talking, several dozen children in various parts of the world have died of starvation. That is a theological issue. And the experience of God that each of us has should get us to the place where we can not only enjoy that personal experience, but use that as a springboard to acting on our faith. So we go from here with the experience of God's presence, however you experience that. But again, it doesn't just stop with that. It's not just about me and Jesus. It's about me and Jesus and all the rest of God's children. So think about that, especially during this time of Lent. Lent is a time to recharge, to think about that relationship, but not only to just build on that relationship, to extend and expand that relationship to all whom we encounter, wherever they may be and whoever they may be. Take advantage of the opportunities that we have. Spend some additional time in prayer and reading the scriptures, and think about what your relationship with God has to say about our place in the world. The church is the last great hope for the world, because we speak with a conscience, and we also speak from that experience of God's love and God's abiding presence, knowing that what we are called to do is to bring that love and be ambassadors of reconciliation wherever we are needed. Amen.